Hi, I'm Malcolm Hawker, and this is the CDO Matters podcast, the show where I dig deep into the strategic insights, best practices, and practical recommendations that modern data leaders need to help their organizations become truly data-driven. Tune in for thought-provoking discussions with data, IT, and business leaders to learn about the CDO matters that are top of mind for today's chief data officers. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good whatever time it is, wherever you are. I am Malcolm Hawker. I'm the head of data strategy at Prophecy Software and the host of the CDO Matters podcast. I'm thrilled to be joined today by John Cook, who is the CTO founder of Dataception. John, how would you define Dataception? Do you see yourself as a data and analytics consultancy mostly? What's the elevator pitch for Dataception?
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Malcolm. So I actually started Dataception 2019 after leaving Databricks and after leaving PwC, building an AI and data practice there and that kind of stuff. And the goal for Dataception was really to, and I know you hear this a lot about, you know, bridging the gap between business and technology and data, but that's something I've been doing for 20 years and did it, you know, at PwC. And what I was really interested in now is actually building customer-facing analytics quickly, iteratively, very much now what we're talking about in data products and that type of stuff. That was what Dataception was founded on, fundamentally. We had to actually deliver a piece of custom analytics to a business within days, weeks, months, that type of stuff, and iterate around on it. So that's what the mission statement really is for Dataception. If you look at some of the architectures and posts I've done back in 2019, it's all talking about that type of thing. So that's really what we're trying to do.
Well, the I think the marketing speak on your site says low friction insight, And I assume that's what you mean by low friction insight is getting something out there that works and be practical, and don't take a 15-month engagement to do it. Do it quicker. Yeah,
exactly right. It's like you know, like we do with UX, right? Where we do like prototypes, we get in front of customers, we get feedback, we iterate around. Same we do in the startup world with product market fit. Same we do what agile is supposed to be. Obviously, you know, the reality is somewhat different, but it's exactly that. It's getting stuff in front of the business, customers, iterating around, delivering it, and not spending these, you know, multi-million pound, multi-year, you know, projects, which we know have challenges, right?
Yeah. Well, awesome. So we had a lot to talk about today. Thanks everybody for joining, for tuning in, for downloading, for listening. Maybe you're taking a run in the park. Who knows? Maybe you're sitting in front of YouTube. All good. Thank you for listening, for checking us out. If you get a chance, please subscribe. That would tickle me. It would be awesome. Give me good motivation to keep creating this content. We got a lot to talk about today. I want to talk about data products for sure. Other than AI, data products remains the number one thing that I'm hearing people talk about in the data and analytics world. It was that way last year, and it certainly remains that way. So data products, love to pick John's brain on that. I'm going to want to talk a little bit probably about the data mesh. I'm not sure we can avoid the data mesh if we're talking about data products. Would love to also explore some of the things that John has been working on from a data science perspective and a language model perspective. So those are going to be the three topics. So stick with us for the entire episode. That would be awesome. John and I, we have a modern relationship. in that, like, I've been interacting with John for well over a year now on LinkedIn, and you know, I support a lot of the stuff that he posts. He supports a lot of the stuff I post. Every now and then, we'll spar a little bit, particularly around the data mesh, which I think is healthy and which is good. But I've actually never been around you in person. But it feels like I've I don't know how many communications we've traded, hundreds.
No, absolutely. It was like a virtual relationship, isn't it? Like an e-relationship, you know, electronic relationship. So, no, it's great. I think there's a lot of synergies in our thinking, which is good. You're a bit of a contrarian. I'm a bit of a contrarian. You know, we tend to go against the mainstream, which is, you know, I think a healthy thing. We always need to test and kind of, you know, play back and shine a light on, you know, on what's going on. You know, echo chambers don't do anyone any good, really. And there's a lot of those in data. We all know that. So And so, yeah, it's been fantastic sort of interacting with you. I think we did a Zoom chat at one time. I think I was talking to a bar in Shoreditch. But yes, other than that, yeah, it's all been electronic.
Well, you were in a bar in Shoreditch. I think I was here in my cave in Florida. But yeah, we had a meeting of the minds with a few of us like-minded folks on LinkedIn, which was a lot of fun. But yeah, no, again. Yet to meet in person, but I'm hoping this year, Big Data London. It looks like I'm going to be there in September. If I can find you through the crowds, that event is
not hard to miss. I'm not hard to miss.
Oh, why? Are you tall?
I'm well over 6 foot, and with a haircut, and I normally have a t-shirt which I print, you know, some kind of designs. So last year it was a great data race, so. Yeah, I'm pretty hard to miss, to be honest.
See, I didn't even know these things. Like, you could have told me you were 7 feet tall, and I was like, really? I had no idea. Or conversely, you know, not.
Apparently, I look quite short on Zoom. Everyone looks at me when they meet me. It's like, oh, blimey, I didn't realize that at all. So I don't know, because I'm low down in the chair or something. But people think I'm you know, a little bit smaller than I am. But anyway,
you've got a lower half. I can't believe it. You've got a low. Anyway, that's funny. So speaking of your T-shirt. One of the things that you talk about often on LinkedIn is you've got this kind of a data product framework, which I think is really useful. And I would invite everybody to check out some of John's posts on LinkedIn related to that. John posts great content on LinkedIn, by the way. If you're not following him on LinkedIn, you most certainly should, because he's one of the people that actually puts a lot of effort in, I think, into the content that he posts. Always provocative stuff, always insightful stuff. So certainly most be checking out John. I've only had one coffee so far today. So,
I'm
babbling,
up, is it?
What's that?
Your engine's still warming up, is it?
It is still warming up. Indeed, it is still warming up. So let's talk about data products. High level question. How do you define them? What makes data products unique to you, John?
So that's a really interesting question. I mean, again, we could probably spend the whole time talking about this. So for me, if we take a step back, so fundamentally, what I've been doing the last 20 years is working with businesses design analytics. I used to do it in risk and banking. I used to do it. I've done it with marketing teams. I've done it with across all different sectors. And the thing for me is there's two hard bits to defining analytics for businesses. One is getting the businesses to actually describe what they want to do. Fundamentally, just distilling down the actual requirement, the outcome, the business goal into something that can be either prototyped or built or whatever. The second bit is something we're all guilty of in the tech and data industry, is actually the time between that, getting that understanding and actually delivering something of value back to the business, right? Those are the two things, right? Now, for me, I've also been through a lot of product startups and launches and that kind of stuff, from like product market fit all the way through. So that product management kind of mentality, I mean, you rarely recognize this, Malcolm, because obviously you're an expert in this space, has a lot of tools in that to actually enable that whole kind of journey between the two things. So for me, a data product, or the data product management is probably a better term. It's just quote Brian O'Neill's term, is the product D way rather than what the actual product is. Is super important to actually bridge that gap, to be able to get something in front of a business user, customer, whatever it is, get the feedback, test it. And if you go into the data science world, it's a very, very similar thing. You know, you come up with hypotheses, you experiment, you do feature engineering, you come up with models, and you're constantly changing, you're constantly iterating. And it's a similar sort of process. So for me, there's a natural dovetailing between product management and analytics. And a data product should be the product of both those things, fundamentally. And that's, so I use that term in a data product pyramid, which is the framework you're talking about, to describe the analytics to business people fundamentally. So I did a thing yesterday on we did a data product workshop podcast, and I describe exactly what it is. So if I go to a business person and they say, I want to understand my historical performance, you know, of my team, of my whatever it is, I say, well, you need some metrics around that. Some metrics that describe the historical performance. I want to understand what my future capacity is. Oh, that's a forecast. I want to basically make a decision. Oh, that's a decision model. Or I want to, you know, and I use the term data product as those components, as analytics, as forecast metrics in business terms to deliver a business value outcome that the business person understands fundamentally. And that to me is really what we should be doing. We shouldn't be getting lost in the tech and data and this of everything else. It's about that taxonomy of language that describes what we're delivering to a business person so they can take it in their own terms, understand the value, understand how it relates to what they do. So that's really what I call a data product. It's that type of thing.
So I totally and completely agree. And there's some of the things you just said, there's a lot to really like. One, you started by saying, what does the business really, really want? Right. So that to me, that needs to be fundamental to a definition of any product. You need to be solving a problem for somebody. And if that's not part of the definition, then I don't know what you're building. You did touch on the discipline of product management, which is how we would build a product, which I do think is incredibly important. We could have an academic discussion whether or not that needs to be part of the definition of a data product, but it certainly needs to be how you'd go about it. So that's another thing that I like. One thing I started to really in my head rabbit hole a little bit as I was listening to you. You raised kind of a data science use case as an example of a kind of a rabbit focus on what a customer would want, like building a model, right? Like, and in this case, the customer, you said a forecast. That's a great one, where I want to forecast how much stuff my customers are going to buy in the future, right? Yeah. An easy one. I need to forecast future sales, right? Looking forward, and I'm going to look at the back, and I'm going to build this model. That to me is a perfect example of what you described. Right, because you have to understand what the customer wants. You have to understand, you know, a lot of things. You need to even understand business dynamics, right? Yep. You need to understand even economic forces, a whole bunch of things you need to understand.
Yeah.
Yet, in the data world, we really get hung up around, 80%. Oh, and by the way, in that process, you would have to be iterative. You'd have to be prototyping. You'd have to be going back and forth to the business and say, what do you think about this? Well, I don't really like this. Okay. And then I'll go back to the lab, right? And then I'll turn the dials a little bit more. What do you think about this prototyping, right? And iterating. Sounds very agile to me. But yet in the data world, we seem to get hung up with the fact that that process takes a lot of time and often can be can produce unsuccessful results. Like it leads to these dumb quotes like 80% of data scientists' time is wasted, right? Or all these 50% of models don't go to production. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Like it seems like there may be some tension there. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So it's an interesting. I think it's a feature of the activity, right? It's a feature of the discipline. I get quite heated when people say 80% of the data science time is wasted on cleaning data. No, it's not. That's not wasted. That's on them understanding the data. Understanding the business. Yeah, data science isn't machine learning. It isn't data engineering. It's basically building business-facing solutions using algorithms and scientific methods. And there's a whole range of things you need to do to be able to understand the business. You understand the data tools and approaches. There's the prototyping, but it's all the producting stuff as well. So I need to go and understand, does the business, can I talk to business in their language? Can I actually deliver something that's got value? Do I understand what that value is? You know, can I also communicate the fact that we're using data science algorithms, that we're only doing incremental, you know, improvements in accuracy? What does that mean to the business person? Because the business person might say, I just want to pass or fail, but actually that's not how that works. So can I communicate that stuff? So there's a range of stuff around that. And I think the shift that we've gone through, where we are going through now in mainstream, this has been happening in kind of niche areas. We're going from modeling data science to solutions. ML and data science solution. A data science solution, you think about you delivering a solution, end-to-end solution, this is where kind of the product comes in. It's not just the model or the data or the algorithm or whatever it is. It's the whole end-to-end piece. It's the support, it's the operating model, it's the entire life cycle of how you deliver that. It's like you're going back to any other product, you know. So for instance, I caught a bit of controversy saying ChatGPT is a great data product. It's a very, very complicated one, but it is actually a product because it's a life cycle. It's like 8 models underneath it, but it actually has customers. It goes through iterations, you know, it has feature enhancements. It's a living, breathing thing that people pay for fundamentally. And data science traditionally has been, you know, a lot of data scientists go, well, I just want to do the modeling bit. It's like, well, the modeling bit's only, you know, if you look at that, the famous Google one where you've got the model, which is like 10% of the whole thing. It's the end-to-end solution. And that to me is the shift that we need to go to, is going from more modeling mindset to an end-to-end solution mindset, and where the model is an important part, but it's only a small part, and there's a whole operating model around it.
Well, so let's kind of steel man the argument around why ChatGPT isn't a data product. Like to me, it's like, well, of course it is, but I'm trying to understand, why would somebody think that it wasn't? What would be the most compelling argument you could make to say that it isn't?
I have, to be honest, I haven't heard one.
Okay.
And I've had this conversation. The interesting thing is, so what, again, if we take a step back, and let's probably touch on the data mesh, because we were going to that as well. So obviously, 5 years ago, and it wasn't just the data mesh, it was a few other people who would classify this a packaged, curated data set being a data product, given that nomenclature, right? That's what's happened, right? So fundamentally, that was the product of, you know, dodgy pipelines and not, yeah, you know, data warehouses not being treated the same level of, you know, robustness as software platforms and what, yada yada yada. So we understand all where it comes from. What was proposed was a bit like what you said before, the sort of the product management process versus the product, is that if we apply product management, then everything will be okay. We'll get the robustness and stuff. And it's like, well, that's more like the robustness of the delivery of what you're doing. So the design, like I said, if I deliver a microservice, I can put CI/CD in there, I can put testing and put all the robustness around it, but it doesn't make it a product. So the product management, product thinking is actually the actual delivery aspect and design aspect of that piece, right? Fundamentally. So, and that's what's caught hold. And the industry has, you know, let's be clear, it's been driven a lot by vendors. It's been driven a lot by, you know, the weight of the marketing budget behind that term being a packaged data set is vast. And it's quite funny. I have quite a lot of conversations on LinkedIn. I've stopped doing that because it's a bit of a time suck, to be fair. It makes me look bad. But there's all that marketing behind it, and that really is the only reason, the only argument I've seen against it. Well, that's what we call it. We now understand this is what it is. And every time I speak to a practitioner and say, actually, it's the wrong term, they go, oh, yeah, it really is, but that the market's already gone there. So really, the only argument against using that term, and we should come up with a different term for these data sets. I think data containers is actually a much better term to describe exactly what it is. And it's important. And let's be clear, I'm not bagging the concept. The concept's absolutely right.
Right. Curated,
and it's got all the nice, you know, technical features around addressable and blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. Absolutely right. It's just not called a product because it's confusing. Because if I go to a business person and say, we're going to deliver a data product and it's a data set, they're going to scratch their head and go, well, what are we doing? Are we selling our data or what, that type of stuff. So I have to translate that product term between business and tech team or data teams. And we should be doing the opposite. We should be flattening it out. Really.
Yeah. Well, totally agree. What I see in this split between kind of data products, a data set as a data product, and a real data product, you know, something that is solving a customer need.
Yeah.
When I hear people say, well, you know, this is really about scalability, it's about governance, it's about reuse, all those things are fine, right? And that's okay. And we should be shooting for that. But I think you're absolutely right. Calling that data set a data product is a little misleading, because to me, like, I am a product person. I built products, right? And I look at that stuff like raw materials. Right. I look at those things as like components, right? They're important. They need to be governed. They need to be managed. You need to do that at scale. And what those components need to be using a mesh phrase, you need to kind of shift left to understand the nature of those components and to get them as close to the kind of the business as possible. But that doesn't mean that those themselves are products, because if they're not delivering value to an end consumer, then they can't, I would argue, they can't be called a product. So maybe we need to come up with another name. I don't know. We've already got too many names for everything we do, but I think we've struck on something here, which is, you know, this idea of a data set versus a finished product. I love how you describe a kind of a finished product as incorporating a whole bunch of things, because as a product person, I would consider that a fundamental of what I would call a go-to-market, right? Yeah. If you have built something like a ChatGPT or integrating something as a ChatGPT that is so transformational that actually requires you, or you could benefit from working a totally different way in order to use the product and to get the value out of the product, to your point, like changing your operating model, right? Or changing a governance policy even simply, right? Like, to me, that's a go-to-market exercise that is a part of that product management workflow that makes total sense. So I think we agree. We've already got too many names for things, but I think that is the core split here, is data product. And when I was at Gartner, they're hung up on data as a product versus data products. Yeah.
So I don't use the word data as a product term at all.
I don't either. I don't either. It's just another layer of kind of, you know, I don't want to say complexity, but possible confusion. Anyway, so let's talk about the mesh a little bit.
Yeah,
I know you're a believer, but you are pretty clear that the way you see the mesh would lean a little bit more towards the socio of the socio-technical than purely technical. And I'm quoting Zemek Deghani, that she said the data mesh is a socio-technical phenomenon, for those who may not know. Do you agree? You seem to be leaning a little bit more on from the perspective of kind of domain centricity versus some of the technical underpinnings of a data mesh. Do you agree?
So first of all, I'm not a big fan of the word social technical because it's
oh, are you not? Okay, interesting.
No, I'm not. All software I've ever built has an operating model that has people in the orbit, so it's all social technical in my regard. But let's move on from that.
Okay.
So for me, the interesting thing is, so I started this journey into kind of composable business facing analytics 2014. I built a management information solution for a bank across 30 or 40 different departments, 3,000 metrics, different domains, so transaction reporting, settlements, confirmations, that kind of stuff. Couldn't have done it in a warehouse. Some people tried and failed. And I built these little composable engines that you could spin up and actually query them for a particular metric that met with a dashboard, this type of stuff, across the different domains, effectively. So this was built, and you know, we showed out and proved it without working and all this kind of stuff back in, let's say, 50 terabytes, you know, 1,000 metrics a second. It was quite revolutionary. And there's a whole different story around why that doesn't exist today. But anyway, it's more political than anything else. But so I proved out that whole kind of concept. So I've been thinking about this for about 10 years, fundamentally. And I published something about 5 years ago called Synchronized View Architecture, which had a similar idea. And to me, that to me is the core of what the mesh vision is. So I believe in the mesh vision. I think there's some challenges with the specificity of the mesh. I think there's a lot of pieces missing and that kind of stuff. And this is why I believe, actually, from an architecture perspective, the architecture I published about 3 or 4 years ago had mesh and fabric components of them. But to me, the mesh vision should be people who own the use case building their own and deploying their own stuff. All connected, but actually deploying their own stuff, you know. And what's happened, I think, with the mesh is, you know, the original mesh proposition was, you know, breaking apart a warehouse like that. We look at that, that's what it was. And the value of the mesh is basically teams being able to share data, domain teams being able to own the data and then share those data sets between. That's really what. And the currency of that was effectively a data microservice, you know, data product, whatever you want to call it. It's a data microservice. Those are the kind of the three key components of it. Now, for me, the value isn't, there is some value in people being able to share data. Let's be clear. Silos are a bad thing, no problem. But the real value is the people who are in the use case to be able to deliver their own components on their own tech to deliver those use cases, right? So there's a sort of Venn diagram between my vision and the mesh's vision. There's quite a bit of overlap, but actually the outcome is actually slightly different. You know, the mesh is about trying to get teams working together, you know, to share data. I'm more about how those business teams or those business facing teams, they don't have to be necessarily organizationally business and centralized, but business facing teams deliver those things. And I'm a great believer that composability, that packaging up of the outcome, but for me, it's not the data, it's the model, it's the data, it's the UX, is a completely end-to-end piece, fundamentally. So I'm a great believer in that. That to me is where the value is, really.
So I got to admit, man, I've got a bit of a love-hate relationship with the mesh, and frankly, a lot of what I post comes out more the latter than the former, and I should probably embrace more of the former. Because the reality is that if you as a centralized IT or a data and analytics function don't give the domains the freedom to do what you just described, they're going to do it anyway. Whether you like it or not, whether as a, you know, if you're a VP of a more of a centralized data and analytics function, if you don't give those business units freedom, they're going to do it anyway. They're going to go hire their own data scientists. They're going to go hire their own analytics people. They're going to go build the reports. On and on and on. This is why Burst, Click, Tableau, I mean, I could keep going on and on, but this is why these solutions exist in the first place, I would argue, to a certain degree, is because they gained a foothold at a lot of functional units who wanted to do their own analytics. So I think you need to embrace that. And if you don't, it's going to happen anyway. So I do like that. I do like the domain centricity. My challenge here is cross-domain. Right. Yeah. And the efficiencies that must and need to exist in order to support cross-domain insights both from an analytic perspective and an operational perspective as well. This is another thing that I have a concern with around the mesh is that it doesn't really kind of address the operational aspects of a business. But how would you speak to that? If you've got a client saying, "Hey, John, I love this. I love the composability. I love it. But at the same time, you know, our business processes traverse function, quote to cash, sales to finance. How do we bridge those?"
So I think that, again, taking a step back, the domain centricity, I think, is actually a little bit of a, I won't call it a red herring, but it's actually, there's a lot of focus on the organization a bit about domain zoning. And that comes from domain-driven design, which has come from software, which is about people building software solutions on the transactional side of the fence to manage their part of the business process. And then you build your object model and this kind of stuff. And there's some very specific bits around that. And you don't expose that whole object model to another part of the business process or another team, right? That's where domain, that's where DDD comes from. That's one of the core underpinnings of the mesh philosophy, right? In analytics, we go into the analytics, and I tend to use the word transactional and analytical because a recommendation engine is an operational system, even though it's an analytical workload. So on the analytical side, you're almost always cross-domain. I mean, it's fundamentally, the analytics by its nature is about trying to work out what's happening in different parts of the business and bringing them together. You know, you're almost always doing it. I totally agree. It's an Achilles heel in the mesh, right? Fundamentally, in terms of actually that whole piece, very much again. But again, you've got to remember what the mesh is doing. It's about sharing data between domains. So it's not really about addressing like a big cross-domain use case. Fundamentally, you know, you have the mesh underneath it, which where the teams share the data, and then someone owns the use case. It's their job then to cross the domains and actually do that. And this is, you know, we can get philosophical about customer facing versus aggregated versus source data products and stuff, blah, blah, and that kind of stuff. That's a bit of a rabbit hole in my mind. So analytics is all about that fundamentally. So I think from my perspective, with our solution, our architecture now, I think we actually have the domain being the model, the solution, and the data actually not being associated with the domain. So people with the use case and spin up a data product, you know, call it, take your forecasting. You know, I want to get an order by sales forecast, for instance. You know, so I want to go to order management. I want to go to sales, I probably want to go to logistics to see what the demand was, that kind of stuff. I want, and the data sets come from all those people, and then I build the model on top, and that all gets delivered as one package. So actually, the whole end-to-end solution is owned by the person who went to the use case, and that's in that particular domain. The data itself needs to be supplied, totally get that, that makes sense, and you have to have all the rigor around it, but actually the domain bit is actually the whole piece. And again, that goes back to what DDD is really about. It's about deploying a whole application with its own model. And that's the way we think about it. So we take bits of data from each of those different three business areas. We combine them, materialize them into a schema inside the model, you know, package, the model container. And we deploy the whole thing as one, fundamentally. So we actually, again, we sort of break the mesh kind of the guardrails a little bit. But actually, that really works. It actually means you're packaging it all together. You're doing the cross domain problem. You're still getting the domain team to own the data to deliver that, however they want to do that. But you're actually owning that cross domain piece as well.
So, in essence, cross domain is a domain.
So yeah, I mean, the way I think about it, I mean, again, we can discuss what a domain is. It's about business process. It's actually cross business process. Really, that's what we're really getting down to. I want to put different bits of data of different parts of the business process, aggregate them either simply through a metric or through something more complicated like a machine learning model or what have you. I want to join those pieces of the business process together with the attributes that I want for my particular use case, and then deliver that as a business facing component. That to me is the secret sauce, and that's what we should all be doing in my mind. Everything else is, and there's obviously layers of abstraction around there, and you sort of start talking about, but there's a data architecture piece in there as well, the data virtualization piece in there, which is, we talk about the fabric, how the fabric comes in to actually really solve that piece. So I think actually the fabric and mesh, those components together, suddenly you get a really winning formula. But you've got to have the clear outcome of delivering an end-to-end piece. If you don't have that, it gets much more challenging.
Yeah, totally agree. The way that I look at it, and it's not centralized versus decentralized. It's not, you know, domain driven versus central IT driven. It's both. And I think for us, as data people, we tend to think very kind of deterministically, right? We have a hard time with seeing things as two or three things as this at once. Often, I know I do. I kind of lean towards deterministic thinking. It's either all or nothing. It's a single source of truth, right? You know, in the NBM world, it's like, okay, well, this is the one version of truth to rule them all, when in reality, yeah. there's multiple versions of truth. There always has been multiple versions of truth. And that's kind of, I'm paraphrasing what I just heard you say, which is there is domain-driven design. There's domain-driven centricity. You can support the needs of marketing, while at the same time, you need to support the needs of your CFO who asks, how many customers do we have? You can do both. Yeah. The real challenge, though, there is not technology, it's governance. Because now, instead of one set of rules, right? If you were just totally, completely centralized, top-down, heavy-handed, old-school, thou shalt type approaches to everything, there's one set of rules, right?
Yeah.
But in the model that you're just describing, there's multiple sets of rules, and they all have to exist, they all have to be documented, they all have to have policies, procedures, they all have to have governance over those rules. And that's where I see the biggest challenge for a lot of organizations is not the fact that the technology can support it, because we know it already can, but it's that it's a fairly mature governance approach to do what you just described. Do you agree?
Yeah, indeed. So there's actually two levels of governance here, right? So again, if we go back to where the mesh comes from, which is basically microservice, and I was doing service-oriented architecture back in 2003, 2004, WSDL and contracts and all this kind of stuff, which always makes me laugh when things like data contracts come. So hang on a minute, that's back 20 years ago.
We're back to the WSDL. I love it.
Yeah, WSDL soap and, you know, all the WS specs around policy and all that kind of stuff. So yeah. But interesting enough, I actually delivered a number of service oriented architectures across different organizations. I actually did one about 2 years ago, interestingly enough. And the governance was always a key part of it, fundamentally, the top level governance. So basically, if I'm producing a bunch of reusable services, how do I make sure I don't get two different teams building the same service? How do I do the versioning around that? How do I make sure if one service contract calls a customer ID one thing and the other one actually has the same thing, how do I make sure those two mean the same thing? So service-oriented architecture always had a governance layer to make sure, you know, my last company we did, I had something called the service governor, you know, British governor. Good. But it was actually someone to actually make sure, because it was a small company, so we could actually do that. Yeah. Make sure that if someone says we want to build a service, I go, oh, well, actually, just extend that one. Let's put another version on there. And are you sure that's calling the same thing? And you know, that is something that was absolutely a key part of it. It was one of the key reasons that service-oriented architecture failed, actually, because they didn't have this governance layer. You ended up this chaos,
right?
You know, people doing this sort of stuff, you know, and it's funny, I see this thing about microservices, you know, obviously it's been around, you know, about 10 years, but I've had many robust discussions with people building microservice architecture. I said, well, how are you doing the governance on that? It's like, oh, it's microservices about decomposing the application. No, it's not. It's about service. The service bit is the bit is the most important bit. The micro is actually an implementation detail. You can do a service-oriented architecture without microservices, believe it or not. People will say, oh, distributed monolith and get all hot under the collar of that. But you can, because I've done that. I did it 20 years ago. But the governance is always there. And we go into the data world. If you're doing any kind of reusable asset and you want them to talk to each other, interoperability, you need governance. Fundamentally, there's no point having someone producing a data set, you know, microservice, data service or whatever, one side and then another one, and they call things different things. They're not going to be able to interoperate. You can get all the technology in the world, but you need that. You need someone to be the arbiter of what the protocol is, fundamentally, which is the data, you know, the semantics and meaning. And that's a classic overarching governance piece. Otherwise, you're just going to end up with chaos.
And you just described the reason why most data marketplaces fail.
Right.
And I'm taking a bit of a left turn here.
Okay.
And I've seen so many data marketplaces come and go. And the reason is because you can publish something and you can even put a contract sitting underneath it or whatever. It doesn't matter. You can publish the schema. It doesn't really matter. If I'm a consumer of data and I'm just looking at something, right? Here's a set of data about, you know, turtles. I don't know. It doesn't matter, right? It's like, oh, well, who published it? And what rules were used to publish it? How do you define a turtle, right? Do you recognize maybe turtle's a wrong example, but you get my idea. Like if it's data about customers or people, like, okay, when was it last updated? What are the governance rules that go into this? How do you define uniqueness? How do you define relationships that exist between the people in your table? So all that stuff, if I'm just looking at a set of data, like maybe a data catalog that just maybe has some basic definitions, of course, but you don't know the underlying governance that went to create that thing, can you turn around and confidently put that into production? Well, if you're a marketer, maybe, right? Because the cost of being wrong, maybe it's okay. Maybe I'm just using this for a shotgun marketing campaign where I'm spraying the internet with ads or something, and maybe it's okay. And 20 to 30% spill is fine. But if I'm in finance, nope. And so I think we're touching on something here that is really, really interesting.
Yeah.
We ask CDOs to be half technical and half business. when I hear data, and I lean on the business side, right? It seems like you straddle right in the middle, which is awesome, by the way.
I do, yeah.
When I hear data contract, what I think is that thing that I have to click every time before I download the app, right? Like the do you agree to these terms, right? Yeah, to terms and conditions. So it's like when I hear data contract, that's what I think. I think, oh man, like you're going to make me agree to use this, like before I download the report, I'm going to have to click, do you agree to the terms of the use of this report? But when a data person hears data contract, they think what you just described, like WSDL schema, like some other, you know, these are the terms of using this data set, right? And here's how they define the data. And here's the field widths and the field types and all the stuff that would go into like backend stuff. And so often most of the CDOs, I think, really kind of fall in more on the data side. When we hear data contract, they think technical. But then there's a whole bunch of others out there that think like, wait a minute, hold on a second. But you have to be both. This is fascinating. And again, it touches on the data set versus data product thing as well.
Yeah. So just one, this is a great thread actually. So if we just go back a little bit to actually the understanding the how the data was created. So one of my favorite kind of paradigms or way of explaining this is Kaggle, right? And if you've come across Kaggle, which is a data science kind of solution where you go in and there are competitions and you say, we've got this data set and we want to kind of predict cancer and stuff. And there's a $50,000 reward to go in there and let everyone piles in and grandmaster. There's, you know, these people get these data science grandmaster titles because they've got won three Kaggle competitions basically around data science. But what's really interesting, I mean, there's some real world things on it. There's a lot of kind of playing and, you know, just sort of, you know, vanity competitions, but it's really good. But it's interesting. If you go into a Kaggle competition, and you see that, so here's a base data set. So we've got like a bunch of cancer survivors, for instance, you know, cancer people who've got cancer data set. Here's how it's made up. Right, now you go and predict, you know, cancer recovery rates or something like that. And you go into all the projects around there, and you see all the working out. You see how the data's been transformed. You see how it's all been done. And then here's the model. Here's the outcome. You actually look into it and go, oh, I see what they've done there. And there's threads around conversations and stuff like that. That is what we should be going to. Fundamentally, in the data one, this is why my definition of a data product has those pieces in it. Because fundamentally, I go and get a bunch of sales data from the sales system, what have you. I pick three or four attributes out that I need. I then transform it and I package it up, do a pipeline, build a model, put some UX on top of it, and then package that all as a product definition, which we have in our platform. The entire definition and the process of that, I can see exactly how that data is used. I can see exactly what the transformations are. I can ask questions of the person who actually built the pipe and say, what did you do there? You know. It's not stuck in some central lake or warehouse where all the aggregations are kind of lost in the mists of time and all that sort of stuff. It's got a very close, short lineage chain that's right back to the actual source system, fundamentally. And I can see how it's been done. So it's not in the abstract. That, I think, is the epiphany we need to get to when, you know, everyone needs to have. If you look at LLMs, that's what they do.
Yes.
Think about it. Very opaque. But it is exactly, they take the raw data and it goes through an encoding, it goes, there's a lot of pre-processing and encoding, and then it goes into vectors, and then it goes into your decoder, and there's some training label data, and you can sort of follow exactly what's, you know, within reason, what's actually happening, but it's still off the raw data, you know, so you can see what the labels are, you can see kind of, you know, you see some of the weight, obviously they're huge, so you can't look at all of them, but it's ironically, it's more transparent than a lot of data warehouses are.
Well, you know. So you're touching on something that's really interesting. And to me, well, so when I was at Gartner last week, this podcast will probably air in another month or so, but last week was Gartner here in the US.
Right.
And one of the key themes was this idea of metadata becoming a first-class citizen, whatever that means. Right. But the concept there is to me, it's all about context, right? And you need the full, it's not just about creating a data set. It's about all the metadata associated with that data set. It's about the lineage associated to it. It's even about other things like context. Maybe you run a graph and on and on and on. But I think the real value here, scale will be delivered and incredible value will be delivered if you, and I use the example of a data marketplace use case. You could use a data sharing use case. You could use any use case where data needs to be shared widely in order to create economies of scale. Where unless you have that layer of, let's call it knowledge, right? Using the data information, knowledge, wisdom kind of paradigm, unless you have that knowledge of the data, which would include the governance, which would include things like who created it, under what situations, what are your business rules for creating it? How do you define uniqueness? How do you define quality? Until all of that gets packaged as a product.
Absolutely.
Like that to me is the aha. Then we can start sharing data because you'll be able to interrogate the data and know, oh, okay, this doesn't really align to how I define a customer. It's interesting, but it's not how I think of the world.
Yeah.
Metadata as a first-class citizen, I think, is important to that. But what I find is really interesting is that we're trying to take a really relational world and make it more like this LLM world, right? And make it more like a text world. So we're talking about vectors and graphs and metadata as a first-class citizen. And what can we do to our old-school rows and columns to provide the knowledge that is sitting there buried in text and has always been buried there in text? I see you nodding. It's these two worlds. I find it fascinating.
Absolutely. So you've got to remember, like, you know, relational databases, whether they're columnar or cloud, whatever, they are a temporal snapshot in time of state. That's what they're a snapshot in time of state, you know, and the relational model of these, my interpretation of what the state of a particular business process system, whatever I'm trying to describe is at that time, I'm going to try and model what I think that state looks like, fundamental relations, this kind of stuff. Now, if you think about a business process and customer, I love customers, one of my favorite ones, because you start look at the business process of a company, so like an e-commerce company or a supply, you know, manufacturing company, whatever. You get the lead generation, you get the prospect, you get the close, you get them in servicing, then you get retirement, then you get customer service, all that kind of stuff. The customer object, business object, not about data object, changes. It morphs based on the particular department or the particular business process that they're doing it. So if the data changes, but yet we're trying to have, we've got this kind of snapshot, kind of static thing. There's a massive impedance mismatch between the two things, fundamentally, right? And we've been driven trying to understand that entire business process or parts of that business process is a, you know, in a relational kind of snapshot model. And if you go to, you know, if we kind of go to the sort of microservices kind of vision and sort of the data mesh, what, you know, that type then, and the data product vision, what we should be doing with analytics, you're putting probes in at different parts of that business process, you know, from an analytics perspective, but the data is going to be different in each of those pieces. And what we're, and then we're giving the insight around what's happening in that part of that process. So I could be measuring a water pipe, you know, at one point I'm measuring the flow, one point I'm measuring the salinity, one point I'm measuring the pH value. And then I've got some understanding about what's happening in that business process. Then I need to get the context of joining at the top of that, above that. So basically joining the pH versus the water flow versus, but that gives me the business context of what's happening at that point. We're a long way from that, from data, because we're still in this relational static kind of world. And that's, if we can break that apart, this is really what microservices were supposed to do. They're trying to break that whole kind of business into small composable components of that business process and then wire them together at the API level. Because the API level, you've actually got a business context. Whereas in data, what you're talking about, a lot of time you've lost it because sometimes it could be an aggregation, it could be a big wide table, 200 columns. You have no idea about the business process. You hope there's some sort of state flag in there or what have you, but maybe not if you understand it, you know, but we're still it's almost like we're trying to compress 3D into 2D. It's that kind of a problem. And I think actually what we need to do is actually get away from this kind of static thinking. I mean, tech isn't there. We're building the tech at the moment, and but it's part tech, but part process, part governance. You've got to solve all these kind of problems around it, which again, I think one of the challenges with the mesh, it has this kind of sort of vision, but there's some big holes in the implementation of how you actually do that piece. And obviously, that's something we've been doing, thinking about for like 10 years. That to me is where companies need to go. And we label it as something called the composable enterprise, where you're actually creating small composable pieces from analytical workloads, transactional workloads. It could be your microservice, it could be your data product as we define them, forecast this kind of stuff. And you can continually, you know, like Lego bricks, you kind of reformat, reconfigure them as the business changes, but you're doing small incremental, you know, deliveries. And obviously that gets challenging with large COTS applications like SAP and what have you, you know, there are challenges around that. But fundamentally, this is the source of most of the friction between the data and the business world. This kind of, I need to compartmentalize and kind of a static representation of this, but actually it's a fluid business process.
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. I wonder, I've been asking the question recently to a lot of really, really smart people, and I'm getting a variety of answers, but I wonder if there's a world where the applications themselves start to get built in a way that doesn't rely on rows and columns. that just dumps everything out to text as a long form narrative, right? Like Nancy in procurement just requested an invoice, right? Like, and instead, right? Like, instead of that getting dumped into a set of rows and columns, have that at getting dumped into literally a story of the business. Where the data is being stored as essentially a narrative or a story. That AI can more easily consume, right? Where there is knowledge embedded and there's information embedded. I don't know. This is getting really high level and totally conceptual. Maybe our listeners are like, man, these guys have gone to crazy town.
No, we've gone well off the reservation. But interesting. If you go back a few years, if you look at triple stores, right? That was kind of going into that sort of world.
Exactly.
Where you're actually now joining data with semantics between them, right? The relationship and graphs now really starting to take
Nancy issues invoice. More of that piece. Yes.
Still a way to go, but it's definitely going much more from the relational into, because graphs are dynamic and they're and the relationship is a first class citizen, and you can have different relationships and that kind of stuff. So this, I think, is really, really interesting, because you are going into that world. It's not just a knowledge graph. It's not, again, knowledge graphs, even though they're dynamic, they're still static representation.
Right.
If you're tying together these kind of components, transactional analytical components, in a graph, in a dependency, on your business process, you actually get the best of both worlds. And something we've been playing with a little bit is around this hybrid graph, where you actually have execution nodes and you have data nodes, and it basically mirrors the business process. An execution node could be a data product, it could be a microservice or what have you. But you're mapping out your business in real time with actual components, and you can reconfigure them. This is obviously less is like, Star Trek when people are at the wheel, but it's that to me is that's really where we should be going. It's that kind of where we are, have a faithful representation of the business process in technology, which is something we struggle. But the problem with that, of course, is a lot of us technology, and I'm guilty of this, we can't compartmentalize that. It's too complicated. It's this kind of envisioning things in four dimensions. It's like,
right,
it's good. I can envision the thing in two dimensions and just about three, but four, it's too hard. So what we do is we try and compress this dimensionality reduction, same in data science. You're trying to take 5 or 6, 10 features down to 3 features, because that's all I can understand. It's the processing power required is actually a lot less. And that's what we do. And that's why we still, it's hard to break out of that mold, because the limits of our cognitive ability to actually understand that kind of spatial awareness, or the spatial dimensional model, is actually very, very, very difficult. But if you take a step back and go, actually, it's not a technology problem. If you start with it, if it's a business process and business process reengineering problem, and you actually then have the tech that actually allows you to map onto those with all the other stuff around it, then it starts to become a different thing, because the tech becomes almost like an implementation detail around that fundamentally. Yeah. But this is kind of where we're going, but it's still a little way off. And part of that is obviously understanding the business process, but coming back to your text and narrative, you can actually say that you'd actually describe that business process in the narrative. Oh, the lead generated leads come in from this particular conference. The X person's qualified that lead and given and hit the 5 check boxes for doing the qualification process. The salesperson's now booked the demo. The demo didn't go very well. We've got some qualitative assessment, maybe even a quantitative assessment around 30%. Did the buyer exhibit buying signal? You can start seeing that sort of text-based narrative, but it's underpinned by a process. You're describing the process in natural language as opposed to through some symbolic language like we do in data.
If I had a giant bag of money, like extra money, and I
you're was going to an island, right? And sitting sunbathing, right?
Well, maybe. Okay, maybe. If I had a bag of money that I had to spend on investing in a company, hypothetical thought experiment, I would be looking at ways of bridging old rows and columns world to this new AI world and this new kind of text-driven LLM world. Because I see LLMs, and this is a good segue in our last few minutes here. I see LLMs kind of becoming this new operating system. And I know that that's just this whole kind of drastically reduced view of the world, but I kind of see things going that way. Yeah. Yet our whole world for decades has been, and I just loosely say rows and columns, but hope you get my point. Like this time, this shot of time, of data that is where you've got to infer a whole bunch of stuff about it in order to create the narrative, or maybe you have to run graphs on top of it to try to understand some of the narrative. And even then it's incomplete. But finding a way to bridge those worlds, that to me is, I think in the short term for classic data and analytics folks, that's good. That's going to be hugely, hugely valuable. But it does require a bit of a mindset shift, like kind of the multidimensionality of thinking, and thinking that two or three or four things can all be concurrently true, right?
Yeah.
When they on the surface may seem contradictory. In our last couple of minutes, and we are running low on time, but I do know that you've spent some time as a data scientist. I looked through your resume. You actually have a data science pedigree. I know you've been doing some work on what could loosely be called smaller language models. So I'll run a hypothetical by you, and I'd love to hear your perspective. Yep. I think that LLMs as a way to model, you know, language and a way to model how humans interact and think is useful. But I think that there's an evolution underway where we will get to more domain-specific language models that are really kind of focused on maybe speaking unique languages, like I speak lawyer or I speak accountant, where you can build these things smaller and far more efficiently, and you don't need 70 billion parameters and 12,000 GPUs to do it, where you will have smaller models that are very kind of task-focused at a domain level. And I think you've been doing stuff that kind of looks like that, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's what's interesting about transformer-based, and it is largely transformer-based, large language models are all about breadth. They're all about the multimodal. Yeah. The kind of let's do lots of things a little quite well. You know, let's do the breadth rather than depth. My first generative AI project was actually 2017, and we were using very simple modeling like Naive Bayes and stuff like. We built our own taxonomy. We wanted a very deep level for a bank, and we were doing things like a call center for investment managers who have deep domain knowledge. So we had to go down the taxonomy of language quite quickly. What's a Bermudan swap, and what's the swap rates, and what that kind of stuff. Once you start going down deep into it, it becomes exponentially more expensive to try and do that in a large model. Fundamentally, because you need to throw so much data in it, and a lot of these domains don't have a lot of data in terms of the taxonomy or enough to nudge the weights to be able to do that. So if you build a smaller language model, and it doesn't happen, and this is the other thing, it doesn't have to be a transformer. So the transformer model is all about, you know, a randomized pattern matching, basically looking for dimensionality between the different tokens, right, fundamentally, and then picking the out of a random set. If you actually use smaller language models, and not just transformer-based ones, attention mechanism ones, but also you start bringing in some NLP and some heuristics around that as well, and you start guiding it around. And one of the ways of doing it is RAG, another way is doing actually with a graph model. You know, there's a load of different ways of doing this. Suddenly you get a much smaller model, much more focused. The training set becomes a lot smaller. The richness of context gets so much better, so much bigger, right, fundamentally. And the accuracy goes up, because fundamentally you're only pattern matching, or you're only matching, you know, smaller numbers of turns. We'd be much more accurate around it, because obviously with machine learning generally, every percentage more accuracy has a, you know, an exponential more cost, and you get to 6%, 7%, and then going up to 80% is going to cost you, you know, 100,000 times more time than that type of thing. It's all about improving the accuracy. But with smaller language models, you have a much better chance of actually doing that. And so we did one a couple of years ago doing generating job adverts. Did one which we get a credit score for, actually describe what a credit score was doing for, and actually calculate the credit score. So it's a mixture of machine learning and also language model, like a generative model to actually generate the report and the output. And it was a combined model as well, which worked really well. So that's the other thing around. It's not, you know, these ensemble models, you know, we talk about mixture of experts, but also bringing classic machine learning, other, you know, and again, comes back to what we talk about, the whole solution. You know, ChatGPT's eight or nine models, you know, and it's reasonable from eight or nine because they're solving different parts of the problem. And that's really where the piece goes. So if you had, like, imagine 10 smaller models doing different parts of your piece, you can train all individually. You're not trying to train one Uber model, thousands of people in far shore locations, trying to do the labeling and correcting, all that sort of stuff. That, to me, is actually from a business perspective. Obviously, B2C is different from a B2B perspective in the enterprise. That is a much more cost-effective and actually much more focused and much more accurate way of doing stuff.
Brilliant. That's where I see things going, although I would argue there's still a bit of a throttle there from the perspective of access to capable data scientists who know how to do that stuff. Because I'm not entirely sure those resources are readily available, nor is there an appetite with a lot of companies to do that. But I certainly see that being the future, from kind of building domain specific models that are focused on very, very specific problems, whether it is job advertising or not. John, thank you so, so much for your time today. Man, I feel like I could have talked for like 2 hours. We could be going on this philosophical rabbit holes about, you know, rows and columns versus text and mesh versus whatever and data products, data as a product. I love the conversation. I hope our listeners got some value out of it. Really appreciate you coming by.
No problem. Well, thank you a lot. Thanks a lot for having me on, Malcolm. It's been an absolute blast. So yeah, I hope we didn't get too esoteric in the clouds. But
yeah. Oh no. Yeah. And also we need a plug for your podcast. You just launched one yesterday. How do I get to it? Is it the Dataception podcast? What's it called?
Called the Data Product Workshop. It's on right. LinkedIn. There's a page on there as well. So yeah, if you link to me just find it on LinkedIn. It's the idea is we're actually doing kind of workshops around actually how you actually do stuff. So we're trying to be a little bit different around, you know, some fantastic podcasts like yourself where we talk, but this is about more around the doing and actually showing how we do it. And
obviously the first one
was about data product storytelling and telling how we do that. And the next one will be around Gen AI and data products. That's probably the next one. Love people to tune in and just see how to do these things, you know.
Awesome. And that's what I love about your content. It's very specific. And that I think people will get a ton of value out of because it goes from concept into how do you actually do this stuff. So awesome. John, thanks again to our listeners. Thank you for tuning into another episode of the CDO Matters podcast. Really appreciate your patronage. Really appreciate you listening. Please give us a like. Please give us a subscribe. We will see you on another episode sometime very soon. Thanks all. Thanks, John. Bye.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye.